Okay, good morning, everybody. 5:31. Whoa, that's really loud. Have to turn that down a little bit. 5:31, and it's November 9th. And let's see, Wednesday. So next week, we don't have a lecture test, even though the chapter that we're on right now, Heart, is the last chapter that's going to be on the next exam. But next week, we have practicum, so I'm pushing off the test until the week after, right? So we're going to take practicums next week, and then the week after, we'll have a lecture test. All right, so the last thing that we want to cover in this chapter that's new is the conduction system of the heart. And under what kind of control is myocardial tissue? Is it voluntary or involuntary? It's involuntary, that's right. So it's not under your conscious control. You can affect your heart rate by doing meditation to slow it down or think about something exciting that will speed it up. But essentially, you do not have control of your heart. It kind of controls itself, number one. And number two, it can be influenced by the autonomic nervous system. And how many divisions does the autonomic nervous system have? It's got two. And what are they? Sympathetic and parasympathetic. They're going to be antagonistic on the heart for sure. And which one is excitatory to the heart? Sympathetic is excitatory, so that means parasympathetic is inhibitory on the heart. It will slow the heart rate down. Okay, so the heart has ways to send electrical impulses throughout the whole myocardium to control when the heart contracts, but also how it contracts. And so there are two main kinds of tissues in the heart. There is the muscle tissue that contracts, and then there are some modified muscle cells that send electrical impulses throughout the atria and ventricles. So what you see on the diagram over here is some things, some tissues that are outlined in yellow, and it kind of makes it look like a nerve. It's not; they're not really nerves. These are just modified muscle cells that transmit action potentials in certain ways throughout the heart to control when it contracts and how it contracts. So the heart, even without innervation, will contract because it has a pacemaker, and it's called the sinoatrial node. The sinoatrial node is pretty much right at the base of the superior vena cava in the right atrium, and these cells right here are autorhythmic. They depolarize or initiate action potentials all by themselves. And it's then, when these cells depolarize, it sends electrical information through both atria, and that electrical signal then causes the heart to contract. So the electrical stimulation has to happen before the heart contracts. So if this ACE node is not causing or initiating action potentials or electrical activity, then the atria won't contract. Right, because that electrical activity has to come before contraction actually happens. And these myocardial cells have special junctions between cells. Now remember, these cells are real short and they're branched. What do we call that junction between myocardial cells? Yeah, they're intercalated discs. And one of the functions of those intercalated discs is to glue the cells together so that when they contract, the cells don't pull apart from each other. But it also has another special little junction between the cells that's called a gap junction. And via those gap junctions, then there are electrical currents that can hop from one cell to another cell, right? It's due to sodium moving in and out of the cells. All right, so these cells are connected to each other electrically because they have gap junctions in the intercalated discs. So all you need to do is to have one cell depolarize, then that depolarization or that signal of excitation will flow through both atria, and we sometimes think of that as an interstitium, right? So when all these cells are connected together electrically, then it functions as one unit. So both atria contract together at the same time because they're made out of a syncytium type tissue. Okay, now what did we see in this plane of the heart? And this is the plane that all the valves are in. And what kind of tissue is separating the atria and the ventricles? Is it a continuous muscle tissue from atria to ventricles, or is there a special layer between the atria and ventricles? There's a special layer that is just fibrous tissue, it's just connective tissue, and that connective tissue cannot transmit electrical activity. And so the atria are isolated from the ventricles, okay, except for one region. And it's this one region right here. So the atria contract before the ventricles do because the atria are excited before the ventricles. This little thing right here, okay, is called the atrioventricular node. So where is it located? Where is the atrioventricular node located? Right between the right atrium and right ventricle, hence its name, atrioventricular node. So this receives excitation via this internodal pathway from the SA node. So it depolarizes, but this right here, the AV node, holds on to that electrical signal for about a quarter of a second or so, right? And that delays the entry of electrical information via the atrioventricular bundle, which then goes through the fibrous myocardium into the left ventricle. So there's only one pathway that electrically connects the atria with the ventricles down over here. All right. Once the signal is delayed in the AV node, then it proceeds very quickly down the AV bundle, and then we can see that the AV bundle bifurcates into the bundle branches as it goes down distally through the interventricular septum. And then once it gets down to the apex right here, there are some other branches that we call Purkinje fibers, which then spread that electrical excitation throughout the myocardium, through all the myocardial cells. And then it goes back up to through the free wall of the ventricles, both the left and right ventricle over here. Right? And so what happens next is that these apical regions of the heart contract, right? And then the more basilar regions of the heart contract afterwards. And that's pretty important because what were to happen to blood flow if the basal regions of the heart contracted before the apical regions down over here? Which way would blood be pushed? Blood would be pushed inferiorly down into the apex, and there are no arteries down there for it to leave the heart, right? So that wouldn't work. So the apex contracts first and it pushes blood up toward the great arteries coming off the base of the heart, which is what, the pulmonary artery, right? Actually, this is the aorta and the pulmonary artery coming out of the right ventricle. All right, so the structures that you certainly should know, right, is the SA node, the AV node, the AV bundle right here, the bundle branches, and then these Purkinje fibers. Right? And so that allows the heart to contract as a unit, but the atria first, followed by the ventricles. Why is it a good idea to have the atria contract before the ventricles? What's the job of the atria? Yeah, to actually help fill the ventricles up with blood. So no sense having the ventricles contract unless they're filled up with blood, and the atria then help do that. Okay? Most of the blood flows right through when it enters the atrium, but the atria do help load some blood into the ventricles. All right, so know these structures. This is a pretty good exam figure. So certainly know everything that's labeled in this dark and black bold print right here. Okay, so the heart contracts as a unit. Now, if somebody's having an infarction, maybe a blood vessel within the heart is being blocked, okay, and maybe it's a blood vessel that supplies blood to this part of the heart that I'm circling right here, this tissue is going to die, right? And then what might happen if this tissue dies? And this tissue is what? The atrioventricular bundle. And that's the pathway for electrical signals from the atria into the ventricle. So if this tissue dies, there is no electrical connection anymore between the atria and ventricles, right? And that could be pretty harmful, except now instead of having one pacemaker in the heart, a pacemaker in the ventricles will develop because all of these cells of the myocardium show autorhythmicity. All right, so, but what will happen is that the atria will contract on one rhythm and the ventricles will contract with another rhythm as a result of that. And clinically, that's typically not too important. All right, but there is another condition that is just as important. All right, so don't forget, atria contract first because they're excited first, then followed by the ventricle, starting with the apical regions right here. But every once in a while, if somebody's having a heart attack, and maybe the bundle branches are destroyed, or maybe even this atrioventricular bundle over here someplace is destroyed, instead of having electrical currents move down through the septum to the apex and then up the free walls, causing contraction just in that order, you can have electrical currents kind of circle around the heart. Right? And when an electrical current circles around the heart, what is that a signal for? That's a signal for contraction, right? Electrical activity precedes contraction. So instead of the heart contracting as a unit, it's going to form little circular contractions, and we call that fibrillation. And so if one part of the heart contracts while the other part of the ventricle is relaxing, and then it goes into relaxation and another part goes into contraction, that's what we call fibrillation. And when the heart is fibrillating, the whole heart is contracting, but not in unison. So it's using up energy. What's the form of energy inside our bodies? ATP. So the heart is using up ATP, but it's not pumping any blood because it's just sitting in your chest, just kind of quivering because of what we call these circular currents that are wrapping around the heart. So this electrical transmission of electrical activity through the heart has to be very particular. And so what happens to you if your heart is contracting but it's not pumping blood? Right? If it's contracting but not pumping blood, we call that fibrillation, right? No coordinated contraction because the synchronized depolarization is lost. The heart is using up energy, right? It's just rushing headlong into just an infarcted state. And so is the rest of your body. Like your brain is always using up ATP as well. All right, so when your heart goes into fibrillation, how many seconds of consciousness do you have? Okay, because when the heart is in fibrillation, it's not pumping blood, no blood is going to your brain. So basically, you have 2 to 3 seconds worth of consciousness. Because no oxygen is getting to the brain and mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP. And then after how long after the heart goes into fibrillation does your brain actually die? So you lose consciousness in 2 to 3 seconds. When does your brain actually die? Because it runs out of so much ATP, it can never recover again. And that's what death is, right? It's an unrecoverable state. When does your brain actually die? Within 2 to 3 minutes. All right, so that's why it's so important to stop somebody's heart once they go into fibrillation. And in some places, I think of Disneyland as an example, they have these automatic electronic defibrillators, right? So these are really kind of fancy instruments. You can put these electronic paddles on somebody's chest, and the instrument can diagnose what condition that person is in. Did they just faint for various reasons? Maybe they were low on foods, or is it because of fibrillation? And if it's because of fibrillation, then it will shock the heart. And what happens when the heart is shocked with a big, strong electrical current? What is the electrical activity? It's a signal for contraction. So when the heart is shocked, the whole heart goes into contraction, and then what happens in most cases is that it goes back to what we call a normal sinus rhythm. Then the heart starts to contract as a unit once again. And when it contracts as a unit, then it starts to pump blood, and it's a really nice way of saving somebody's life. And some people who are prone to fibrillation actually can have a defibrillator implanted right in their thoracic cavity. So it's always monitoring their heart, and if they go into a fibrillation, then it will shock their whole heart. Hopefully they're not driving down the same freeway I am. All right, I'm sure it's a very unpleasant circumstance, but that's much better than losing your life in 2 to 3 minutes. All right, but what else can you do for somebody that's in fibrillation? And maybe you don't even know. You can do chest compressions if you're CPR certified, right? So for somebody that isn't breathing, you can breathe for them by mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. But if their heart is not beating, and that you can tell just by checking a little radial pulse. You can do chest compressions. That compresses the ventricular chamber, which forces a little bit of blood, okay, into the aorta, which then perfuses, hopefully, enough blood to the brain to where you preserve their brain until they can get to a hospital or somebody can bring a defibrillator, like a paramedic, okay, to start their heart back up again. Okay, so this conduction system is really important. All right, so in terms of innervation of the heart, right, even if we rip somebody's heart right out of their chest and put it on a tabletop someplace, it's going to beat because of this sinoatrial node, just like Raiders of the Lost Ark. Or is that such an old movie, people don't even know what that is anymore, I'm not sure. Okay, but a heart will beat by itself because the SA node is autorhythmic, right, but it can be influenced by your autonomic nervous system. Parasympathetic has chronotropic effects. That means, what's a chronograph? It's like a wristwatch, okay? And so parasympathetic innervation can adjust heart rate. And what it does is that it slows the heart rate down. That's its job. It slows the heart rate down. So it has a negative chronotropic effect, both on the SA node and the AV node. Sympathetic innervation, on the other hand, can increase heart rate, but it also has what we call inotropic effects on the ventricles. So sympathetic stimulation can increase heart rate, but it can also increase the force of contraction. So under sympathetic activity, the heart rate increases and the force of contraction increases. That's a lot different than parasympathetic. Parasympathetic cannot affect the force of contraction. It can only slow the heart rate down. All right, so those are the two main effects. And the parasympathetic nerve that goes to the heart is the vagus nerve. And for the next test, I'm sure you have to know what number is the vagus nerve. It's a cranial nerve. It's number 10. Yeah, cranial nerve number 10. Well, it goes all the way down to the heart. Okay, but that's one interesting thing about the vagus nerve is that it goes pretty much everywhere in your body, right? It just kind of meanders around through your body, and hence that's how it got its name, right? The vagus nerve or vagabond nerve, just traveling around all over through the body. All right, anybody have any questions on the conduction system of the heart? Okay, so it tells the heart when to contract, but also how to contract. How many chambers does the heart have? How many valves does the heart have? Okay. And as far as the chambers go, do all four chambers contract at the same time? No, they don't. Which ones contract first? Both atria contract together, followed by both ventricles, and the ventricles contract at a later time because there's a delay right here in the AV node, and that's the only way that these electrical signals can get through the fibrous myocardium into the ventricles right here. Okay. All right, so now I want to go back to one of the first pictures in your textbook that we talked about. It's this one right here, all right? But it's so important when it comes to the heart that we're going to review this one again. And when you look at this picture, you'll see that the heart indeed has four chambers, right? The two superior chambers are the atria, right atrium, left atrium, and then inferiorly two ventricles. Sounds like I lost my microphone again, huh? Is that red? Oh, who knows? Yeah, somebody might know if that's red. Okay. I think I have some batteries down over here. So let's see. So four chambers, the two atria, two ventricles, and there is a valve between the atria and ventricles. What do we call those valves? What are the valves between atria and ventricles? Yeah, those are specific names. But in general, what's a general name for those valves? I'm going to try and carry on a conversation while I'm changing batteries. Hopefully I won't electrocute myself, but these are just batteries, so it's not likely. Okay. Those are atrioventricular valves, right? And you got two of them. What's the one on the right side? The tricuspid, and the one on the left side is the Bicuspid. What's another name for bicuspid? Yeah, mitral valve. All right, let's see. Maybe I have to adjust the gain on this. Maybe not. Do I hear any weird things? No, it just came back. Good. Okay, so here's an atrioventricular valve. Here's the bicuspid or mitral atrioventricular valve. And then what kind of valves are these right here? There are two of them. These are the semilunar valves, right? The pulmonary semilunar valve and the aortic semilunar valve, which is posterior to it. What's the most anterior great vessel coming off the base, of the heart? Yeah, it's a pulmonary trunk, right? That's the first one you see. So don't get that one mixed up with the aorta, which we all consider is the most important vessel. Okay, but here's the aorta. It's posterior to the pulmonary trunk. And indeed, the right pulmonary artery goes underneath the arch of the aorta. All right, so how many sides does the heart have? It's got two sides. So you can see in these two different colors right here. You got blue and red. All right, now the colors don't signify whether something is an artery or a vein. It only signifies the state of blood in a particular part of the circulatory system. So blue right here signifies what condition, what state? Relatively low oxygen, relatively high CO2. All right, and red is relatively high oxygen and relatively low CO2. It's not completely devoid of CO2 in red, and the blue is not completely devoid of oxygen. It's just relatively low in oxygen. Okay. What kind of blood vessels do you see? You should see three. What are three kinds of blood vessels on this diagram that you see? And not by color. Okay. It's by direction of blood flow. Give me the name of a blood vessel that you see. You guys must be sleeping up there. I can't see you. Or you're surfing. I'm not sure. Go ahead. Somebody tell me. What are the three kinds of blood vessels that we see? Arteries. Yeah, arteries. So an artery does what? Takes blood away from the heart. All right. So here is a nice red artery. Is there such a thing as a blue artery? Yeah, look over here. Here is an artery taking blood away from the heart. It's relatively low in oxygen, and this is the pulmonary artery. So remember, an artery is just a vessel that takes blood away from the heart. So a vein does what? Brings blood back to the heart. And the third kind of blood vessel are these really small ones over here, and these are called capillaries. And why do you need capillaries? That's where exchange takes place. That's the only place where things can enter or leave the cardiovascular system. Can't leave via an artery, can't lead via a vein, and in the next chapter we'll see why that is. All right, so one of your assignments for the pre-lecture reading assignment was to trace a drop of blood around through the whole circulatory system, okay? And how many circulatory systems do you have? You got two, right? You got two sides of the heart, you got one pulmonary circuit, one systemic circuit. So trace a drop of blood through the whole circulatory system, naming all chambers, all valves, and blood vessels, right, as it start in one place and then finish up in that same place, right? Plus also then designate what the state of blood is in each of those locations, right? So that you should do and be able to do in your mind, all right? So let's practice doing that on the board right here. So where would you like to start tracing a drop of blood? Want to start in the right atrium? Okay. So let's put this down. I'm going to abbreviate. Right atrium. What's the state of blood in the right atrium? All right. So you can use the diagram for now, but you should be able to do this without looking at a diagram, certainly before the test. Might even be helpful on the practicum. Maybe not as helpful. Okay. So right atrium, what's the state of blood right there? Is it high in oxygen or low? Low in oxygen. All right. So I'm going to put down down arrow, okay, low O2. So where does blood flow from the right atrium? In the right ventricle. This is true, but we missed something. We got to go back. We got to write down all valves too. Okay, so right atrium, we got to go through the tricuspid valve. And what kind of valve is tricuspid? It's an AV valve, right? Atrioventricular valve. What about the state of oxygen? It's still low because there's no capillaries involved right there. Tricuspid then, where does blood go after it passes through the tricuspid? Right ventricle, we're going to say RV. Is there any exchange taking place right here? No, no capillaries, so it's still low oxygen. Right ventricle, where does it go after the right ventricle? How about the pulmonary semilunar valve? Okay, any exchange taking place there? No, so low oxygen, pulmonary semilunar valve. Blood flows then into the pulmonary what? Trunk. And what is the pulmonary trunk? An artery or a vein or a capillary? It's an artery. All right, so I'm going to put pulmonary artery right here, but you should know it's pulmonary trunk, and then that bifurcates. All right, what's the state of oxygen in the pulmonary? I'll spell it out. In the pulmonary artery, what's the state of oxygen in the pulmonary artery? It's still low, right? Even though it's an artery, it has low oxygen because it's in the pulmonary circulation. Pulmonary circulation is opposite to the systemic circulation. And then where does a pulmonary artery take blood? Yeah, and what kind of blood vessels are in the lungs? Capillaries, right? So I'm going to say lung capillary. All right, now what's happening in this capillary? Something special. Exchange. All right, so exchange is happening, which means what? Exchange means that O2, yeah, okay, let's start there. CO2. CO2 goes out, and O2 goes in to the blood, right? That can only happen in a capillary. Then after one capillaries, where does blood go? Pulmonary veins. Why is this called a pulmonary vein? Because it's going to take blood back to the heart. Now, what's the state of oxygen in a pulmonary vein? It's going to be high. Are you sure, even though it's a vein? Yeah, because it's coming back from the lungs, so oxygen is going to be high. Pulmonary vein, where does the pulmonary vein take blood? Left atrium. Does it have to pass a valve to get there? No, does not. Okay, so pulmonary vein into the left atrium. And what's the state of blood? Just same. It's going to be high in oxygen. Left atrium is going to have to pass the mitral valve, that's an atrioventricular valve on the left-hand side of the heart, into what, the LV. Oh, and what's the state of blood in these places? It's still high in oxygen, relatively high in oxygen. Left ventricle, it's going to pump blood into the aorta, but it's got to pass the aortic semilunar valve first, and that's high in oxygen into the aorta. And the aorta is high in oxygen. Aorta then is going to carry blood to what we call systemic capillaries. And what happens in these systemic capillaries? Exchange. All right, but in this case, what did we start with? CO2. CO2, instead of going out, CO2 goes into the blood vessels, okay, from the tissues, goes in, and what about oxygen? Oxygen goes out or leaves the blood vessels. All right, so we got systemic capillaries, and then what? Let's go here. Systemic capillaries. Give me the names of some of the great vessels at the base of the heart. We've got the vena cava, right? Superior and inferior vena cava. Superior / inferior vena cava. Sometimes these are just abbreviated SVC, right? / IVC. These are pretty common acronyms for superior, inferior vena cava. What's the state of blood in the vena cava? Low oxygen, high in CO2, right? Low oxygen, and vena cava then take blood to where? And then we're back where we started. right atrium. All right, so be prepared to trace a drop of blood anywhere through both pulmonary and systemic circulation, starting any place. All right, but don't forget all the four valves, the four chambers, and probably the most important thing to know about are these capillaries, right? The sites for exchange. All right, so that's it for the heart system. Is there anything that I want to talk about? I think not, because we talked about the layers and the fibrous pericardium, all that kind of stuff. Okay, that sounds pretty good. All right, well, where does that take us next? That takes us to the vascular system. Vascular system. So let's start the vascular system. Okay, let me get some slides. Circulatory system. Sounds good. All right. Well, this is, now we're going to get back into some pretty classic anatomy, because we always said that layers are real important, right? Like layers of the skin, right? They have important functions. Well, blood vessels have a number of layers as well. Let me just take a look at this slide real quick. Okay. This is pretty good. So here's a micrograph. Here we see an artery that's really nice and circular. Here we see a vein that has kind of a weird shape to it. And this is true because arteries have a lot thicker wall. They have more muscle associated with them. There's a lot higher pressure inside an artery, so they have a tendency, they're always going to be inflated, right? Veins may or may not have a lot of blood in them. If they don't have a lot of blood, then they start to collapse like this to some degree. Okay? All right, so that's kind of one difference between arteries and veins. But here's a really good diagram that shows the different layers in different kinds of blood vessels, all right, and what the layers are made of. So let's start with the innermost layer, all right, the deepest layer right here. Can anybody remember what the innermost layer of the heart is called? Yeah, the endocardium. Endocardium, and remember, it's slippery and smooth so that blood flows through the heart without generating blood clots. So you should probably imagine that the innermost lining of a blood vessel should be slippery and smooth as well. Of course, it doesn't have endocardium, but it has an endothelium. It's just a simple squamous epithelium that lines a blood vessel. And this, the deepest layer right here is called the tunica intima. And tunica just means like a coat or a layer, right? A tunic is just a layering over, for instance, your body. All right, so you've got the endothelium, then you have some connective tissue, the subendothelial layer, and then you have some elastic tissue. And what's the beautiful thing about elastic tissue? It can stretch, right? And then after the expansive force dissipates, like when the heart goes into relaxation, then the blood vessel goes back to its original diameter. So these three sublayers make up the tunica intima. All right, the tunica media, we see, has some thicker layers right here, and this is smooth muscle. All right, so this helps maintain the integrity of the blood vessel, even though it might have high pressure running through this particular tube. All right, so these smooth muscles can constrict, and that prevents the blood vessel from blowing up. And it also has an elastic layer to it, so that when the heart contracts, there can be a big bolus of blood flowing through this vessel. It can expand a little bit, and after that bolus of blood passes through it during relaxation of the heart, then the blood vessel goes back to its original diameter. Okay, and then the last layer, the tunica externa, is just connective tissue with collagen fibers, and that's the toughest layer of a blood vessel. But it can't contract because it doesn't have muscle associated with it. Okay, some blood vessels, really big ones, are so thick that the blood that's flowing through them is so far away from these muscle cells that it can't support the life of these muscle cells. So some blood vessels even have to have blood vessels running through them as well. We call that vasovasorum. right? So some really big blood vessels even have tiny blood vessels running through them with capillaries to make sure that these blood vessels stay alive. All right, so this is a pretty good example of a general artery. And if we compare the wall thickness of an artery to the thickness of a vein, can you see which one is thicker? I think these are drawn pretty much to scale. Okay, from here to here, can you tell which is thicker, from here to here or from here to here? This is a good area to watch, right? So the arteries are thicker than veins. And that's something that you'll notice when we start doing a pig dissection in 2 weeks. All right, that's one way to tell an artery from a vein. All right, so then blood flows from a large vein into a small artery. We would call these things arterioles. They have a lot of branches, and arterioles feed then a capillary. Arterioles have the same layers as these arteries do. They're just not as thick. Okay, but when blood actually gets into a capillary, the nature of the layers change quite a bit. And as a matter of fact, you only have, I think of it as one layer, but there's actually maybe two layers that make up a capillary. There's that simple squamous epithelium, which is an endothelium because it lines the tube. So what do we call that? What do we call this simple squamous epithelium? That is just an endothelium. So here is an endothelium. How many cell layers thick is that? Just one layer thick. And then there's a very thin basement membrane that kind of anchors this capillary to the tissues that it's coursing through. And because this blood vessel is so thin, it allows for exchange in and out. But there are different kinds of capillaries that we're going to see in a minute, right? Some of these cells and certain kinds of capillaries are far apart, and some of the endothelial cells actually have pores in them which aid in exchange. From inside the blood to extracellular spaces, right? So remember, exchange takes place in a capillary, and then blood flows out of a capillary, and through these anastomoses, it forms a venule, which is a small vein, and small veins come together to form regular types of veins that we see right here. And you see that the tunica externa pretty much is the same size. Notice that the smooth muscle region here is really a lot thinner compared to arteries, and that's because veins contain very low pressure blood, not high pressure. So they're not prone to overextending or over dilating because of high pressure or forming aneurysms or dissections, which would be a rip in the artery wall. All right, but nonetheless, it still has an endothelium. What's this job of the endothelium again? Smooth and slippery, so blood flows over it. Okay, without forming blood clots. But I see another structure in a vein. It reminds me of the heart in a couple of different ways. What else do I see in this vein that I don't see in this artery? Which is kind of funny because I see more things in an artery wall than I do in a wall of a vein. But here's an additional structure in a vein that I don't see in an artery, which is a valve right here. Okay? And the job of this valve is to prevent retrograde flow of blood because the pressure is so low in a vein that that low pressure sometimes by itself can't direct blood flow back to the heart. Sometimes it's going to want to move back down to your feet or to the periphery of a upper limb, but these valves inflate and prevents retrograde blood flow, so it only can flow back to the heart. So just like the heart, veins do have valves positioned periodically. And I suppose, you know, if you were to clench your fist and look at your forearm in superficial veins, you can actually see like little bulges or bulbs form along the course of a vein. And those are the valves that are inflating and working, preventing retrograde flow of blood back down into your fingers. Okay. Okay. So these structures you should know a lot about. Here. Vasovasorum, not shown on this diagram, but remember, some arteries are so big and thick. Like, tell me, what do you think the thickest artery is in your body? Yeah, the aorta. And it's probably the highest pressure because it's coming right from the heart. For sure, the aorta has a vasovasorum on it, okay, throughout it supplying blood to those internal structures. All right, so you've got arteries, takes blood. Don't forget definition of an artery. Takes blood away from the heart. Maybe I can increase the scale of this a little bit. Okay, so an artery takes blood away from the heart. Don't forget, it could be oxygenated or deoxygenated. In your notes, make sure you write down an example of each. Name an artery that is oxygenated. You would want to say, what kind of artery is relatively high in oxygen? Yeah, the aorta would be a great example. What's the name of an artery that is relatively low in oxygen? Like the pulmonary artery, right? Part of the pulmonary circulation. Arteries have high pressure, okay, because blood is a fluid, and fluid will only flow if there is a pressure gradient, right? So how will a fluid flow according to pressure? From low pressure to high, or from high pressure to low? It's only going to flow from high pressure to low. So the heart is high pressure, arteries are high pressure, veins are low pressure, so blood will flow through capillaries. Right, and where would you guess the lowest pressure is? Okay, in the right atrium, so that blood flows actually back to the heart into the right atrium. Okay, because of these different elastic layers or muscular layers within an artery, there are different kinds of blood vessels. Right, large arteries are called conducting arteries. These are near the heart. They don't have as much muscle in them as some other arteries, but they have a lot of elastic tissue, so that when the heart contracts and shoves a lot of blood into the aorta, it can actually expand quite a bit. And then when the heart relaxes, those elastic fibers cause the shrinkage of the aorta back to its original shape. Right, so we call that a conducting. Right, smaller and medium arteries are what we call distributing arteries. They can vasodilate, they can shrink down, okay, or they can dilate because they have a smaller elastic layer and more smooth muscle, so they can control their diameter. Right? And that's very important because the amount of flow through a blood vessel is related to the radius of a blood vessel. And it's significant. We call it the fourth power rule. So when there's a small change in radius of a blood vessel, there can be major changes in blood flow. And that's the major way that blood flow is controlled through various parts of your body at different times. So for instance, when you're exercising a muscle compared to when you're sleeping, should it have more blood flow or less? A lot more, because it's a lot more metabolic. And the way that that is controlled is by vasoconstriction or vasodilation of blood vessels to those muscles. So for instance, radius is good. All right, so let's just start out with, and just say that a blood vessel has a radius of 1, right? And then we measure blood flow and we measure it to have a blood flow of 1. I'm not going to tell you what the units are, but now let's double the radius of this blood vessel. So it's going to dilate. What about blood flow? Does it just go up by a factor of 2, according to this table right here? It goes up by the fourth power rule, which is what? What's 2 times 2? 4. What's 4 times 2? Is 8. And what's 8 times 2? That's 16, right? So that's the fourth power rule. It's 2 times 2 times 2 times 2. So there's a change in blood flow by a factor of 16. So small changes in the radius of a blood vessel can cause major changes of blood flow through that particular tube, right? Or for instance, if the radius of a blood vessel changes by a factor of 5, what about blood flow? It would be 5 times 5 times 5 times 5, which turns out to be 625 times more, right? So that's a huge change. Okay, arterioles can vasodilate and vasoconstrict as well. And when we say vasodilate and vasoconstrict, what is the concept that you should actually be thinking about? Okay, the shape of the blood vessel certainly is changing, but that means what? If the structure of a blood vessel is changing, what else is happening? The function. And when I say function, I mean blood flow through that vessel, right? So arterioles can, right, control blood flow through various parts in your body by vasodilation or vasoconstriction. Okay, and they can do that by two different ways. by local control or by the amount of sympathetic innervation that's stimulating that particular muscle. We would call that sympathetic tone. All right, so local control, for instance, means that the metabolism in that area where you find these arterioles is influencing vasoconstriction or vasodilating. So let's think of a muscle. A muscle at rest, right? A muscle at rest, is it, it's not exercising very much, so it's not utilizing a lot of oxygen, and it's not using up a lot of ATP, and under those circumstances, it's not producing carbon dioxide, and it's not producing lactic acid. So under those circumstances, does it need a lot of blood flow to maintain homeostasis or to maintain metabolism inside those cells? It doesn't. So under those conditions, when a muscle is at rest, it's not producing any kind of chemicals that cause vasodilation, so those blood vessels are going to be vasoconstricted. But as soon as a muscle starts to exercise, what does a muscle produce when it exercises? Even though you maybe haven't taken a biochemistry class or physiology, you might have a sense of a compound that is produced when you exercise a muscle very strenuously, and it hurts even. It produces lactic acid or lactate. That lactic acid goes and affects the muscles around these arterioles, causing them to dilate. And as they dilate, what happens? It increases blood flow tremendously. It brings in a lot of oxygen so that muscles can use glucose to produce ATP, which is necessary for contraction. It washes out carbon dioxide, washes out lactic acid, right, and it preserves the health of those muscles. So that's what we call local control. Right? And it doesn't require any nervous system or brain for it to work properly. Sympathetic activity, right, is due to, well, sympathetic impulses that come from your brain. Right, and these might be tied to various other kinds of reflexes. Maybe you have receptors in the brain that monitor pH and CO2 and oxygen, and as a result, they can work through the nervous system to cause either vasoconstriction or vasodilation. And you also have pressure sensors in various parts of your body. The region where you have very important pressure receptors that we call baroreceptors are in the carotid sinus. And I think I told maybe two or three lab groups where the carotid sinus is. All right, I got to mention that today. In lab, I mentioned it. Okay, your book doesn't do a really good job of mentioning it, but it's a very important region for monitoring chemicals like CO2 and oxygen and pressure. And can anybody remember from lab, what is that area, okay, that can measure pressure in blood vessels? It's right at the junction of the common carotid. When it bifurcates into the internal and external carotid, there's a little bulge in those arteries right there called the carotid sinus. All right, so that will then be used to affect sympathetic tone of vasoconstriction or vasodilation in arterioles in all over your body, as well as venules as well, to help maintain blood pressure. For the following reason. Okay, if you have a balloon and it's tied off, it's filled with fluid or air, water or air, if you squeeze the balloon, what is squeezing the balloon like? Vasodilation or vasoconstriction? It would be like vasoconstriction. So if you squeeze a balloon, what's going to happen to pressure inside that balloon? It's going to go up. So if your blood pressure starts to drop, those baroreceptors in the carotid sinus will cause vasoconstriction to bring your blood pressure back up so that you don't faint. Okay, so that's another important. That's not local control, but that requires reflexes, and so we call that sympathetic tone. Okay, the precapillary sphincter. All right, you learned of a bunch of circular muscles in your body, like the orbicularis oculi, orbicularis oris. Those are circular muscles. But what kind of control are those under? Yeah, voluntary control. Okay. Now, a sphincter is a circular muscle, but it's made out of smooth muscle. So it's not under voluntary control. You can't control these things. These things control themselves, right? Or maybe through sympathetic activity. So these things can constrict All right, and then, so here is a capillary bed, and at the entrance to every capillary bed, there is what we call a precapillary sphincter. Sphincter is just a circular smooth muscle. When it constricts, the radius of this constriction right here goes way down, or the radius goes way down. What happens to blood flow through this capillary? It goes way down. It decreases, right? Like a muscle at rest, right? And if this is a capillary in your digestive tract, when would you expect to have a lot of blood flow going through these capillaries in your digestive tract? Like after a meal, right? When you're in what we call a fed state, right? When you're not in a fed state, you're in a fasted state, then you don't need to have blood flow going through capillaries of your digestive tract because you're not digesting and absorbing any nutrients as a result of that. And as a matter of fact, you don't have enough blood in your body to go everywhere at one time. So your body has to pick and choose where blood is going to go. And that's why your mother always told you what? After lunch. You wanted to go swimming. And what did your mom say? No, you can't go swimming because you just had lunch. Because if you just had lunch, where is a bunch of blood going? These precapillary sphincters in your digestive tract are dilated. A lot of blood is going through your digestive system. And then all of a sudden you start exercising. Okay, you don't have enough blood to go to both places. That might form some cramps in the part of your body, like maybe stomach muscles, arms, or legs, because they're not getting enough blood flow. As a result, and if you're in a swimming pool and you have a major cramp like that, then of course you could drown. You might not be able to hold your head above water, right? So you don't have enough blood in your body to go every place at the same time, and it's these sphincters and smooth muscles and arterioles that control where blood goes at a particular time. Okay, here is a meta-arteriole. When these precapillary sphincters close, then blood goes directly from an artery into a vein, right, bypassing this capillary. Okay, so capillaries are the smallest blood vessel. They're just a single layer, just a simple squamous epithelium that allows for exchange, and exchange happens by diffusion. So compounds will move from a high concentration to low concentration. All right, so where is oxygen at a low concentration? In a low concentration, is it going to be in the blood in a capillary or in tissues outside the capillary? Okay, where will oxygen be low? Remember, substances can only move by diffusion from high to low. Where do you want that? How do you want that oxygen to move? You want to have it move from the blood to a cell. So which has lower oxygen concentration, the blood or a cell? The cell has lower oxygen concentration. Otherwise, oxygen would never diffuse into it, right? And right, then it wouldn't be able to survive. Same thing for carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide moves by diffusion. Where is high carbon dioxide? In the cell or in the blood? It's going to be high inside the cell, so carbon dioxide moves from the cell into the blood, right? And then the blood takes it to your lungs and you exhale it from your body. Okay, so that's what we mean by diffusion. Okay, there are three kinds of capillaries in your body. Let me show you some nice diagrams of some capillaries. Okay, and it's by order of how leaky they are. So here's a typical kind of capillary. Most capillaries are so small that only one red blood cell can squeeze through at a time, right? And it's probably bumping up against the wall of a capillary, but that's okay because a capillary has an endothelium, which is what? Smooth and slippery, so it can just kind of sneak through with no problem. So here is one cell. Here's a neighboring cell. And look, we have an intercellular cleft between the cells, which makes it what? Leaky. It makes it easy for exchange to happen through this intercellular cleft. So not only can fluid leak out, but other things that are dissolved in that fluid. But these intercellular clefts are so small that a red blood cell can't leak out. All right, so it's trapped inside the capillary. All right, so this is what we call a continuous capillary. This is the least leaky kind of capillary that just has these intercellular clefts to it. All right, the next leakiest kind right, is right here. It still has intercellular clefts, but it also has, right, these pores or holes within the cells. We call these fenestrations. And because it has additional pores within the capillary, that makes it more leaky. So that it, does that enhance or does that inhibit exchange? That enhances exchange. So these capillaries are in parts of the body where you want to enhance exchange. For instance, maybe in the small intestine for absorption, and the kidney, which is a special filter for blood. Okay, so you got fenestrated capillaries that have these extra pores in them. And then the third kind, right here, we call this a sinusoidal type capillary. And sinusoids have these large intercellular clefts, almost large enough for this red blood cell to leave, but not quite. Right? And it has large fenestration. So this is a really leaky kind of capillary. And we find this pretty much only in the liver and in bone marrow and the spleen, where a lot of plasma can leave and it's filtered by the liver and filtered by the spleen. Okay, and so there's a lot of fluid that leaves the blood in these sinusoidal types of capillaries. All right, so that's pretty much true of whether something is an artery or a vein or a capillary. So let's look at the circulations, pulmonary circulation. Pulmonary circulation. All right, I think you're kind of familiar with pulmonary circulation already. What kind of diagrams do we have? You know what? I don't think you have many diagrams in your book of pulmonary circulation, except for maybe this one right here. All right, so pulmonary circulation comes from the right side of the heart. Right ventricle pumps blood into the pulmonary trunk, which then bifurcates into right and left pulmonary arteries. And then this enters the lungs, and then the arteries bifurcate into smaller and smaller and smaller arteries. And what color are the pulmonary arteries in this lung right here? So if I go over here and hold the cursor right here, is this a pulmonary artery right where the cursor is? What color do you see? I better check before I talk about this. What color does that look like to you? It's red. Good. I have the cursor in the right mark. So is this a pulmonary artery or a pulmonary vein? This is a trick question. It's a vein, even though it's red, because red means what? Oxygenated, and blood coming back from the lungs, right, is in the pulmonary vein, because that's what a vein does. It brings blood back to the heart, and so it's oxygenated. And these blue vessels here are the pulmonary arteries. Okay? So here you see the right pulmonary artery going into the right lung, and then it becomes oxygenated and it returns to the heart, in particular the left atrium, via the pulmonary veins that are high in oxygen. Right? And the lung has these little structures right here that we call alveoli. They're surrounded by a capillary network. Here's a little capillary. Each one of these little alveoli have hundreds of little capillaries surrounding them, and so that enhances exchange, so CO2 leaves the body, oxygen enters, just like what we wrote on the board right here. So this is the pulmonary circulation. Then once blood gets back to the left atrium, then we should consider the systemic circulation. Right? So then it passes the bicuspid valve into the left ventricle, past the aortic semilunar valve into the aorta. What are the first couple branches of arteries off the aorta? Not shown on this slide. That's a hint. It's kind of a trick question. Okay. These you know from lab, at least if you had lab this week already. Some people didn't have lab already this week. Here's a brachiocephalic. Here is the left common carotid. Here's the left subclavian. All right. But guess what? These aren't the first branches off the aorta. Okay. Here is the aorta. Here's ascending the aorta. Here's arch. And then descending goes behind the heart like that. There are some blood vessels that come off right in the root of the aorta that supply blood to the myocardium itself. And does anybody know what a blood vessel that supplies blood to the heart is? Not these chambers right here, but actually feeds the metabolic demands of the heart itself. Those would be the coronary blood vessels, right? Coronary arteries and coronary veins. So the first branch are the coronaries, and then the second branch would be this brachiocephalic right here. Okay, so this probably is a good exam figure for you to know. And something funny is happening. Good, it went away. It came back. All right, so let's trace, let's look a little bit, okay, at the arch of the aorta. And, well, let me finish the aorta off. So here's the arch, and then you have descending division of the aorta down to this first bifurcation. Right at the bifurcation, the aorta turns into both the right and left common iliac arteries. Right, but the aorta has two main divisions. At least the descending aorta has two main divisions. Above the diaphragm is the thoracic aorta. Then below the diaphragm is the abdominal aorta. So let's pay attention up over here more first before we get back down to this region. Brachiocephalic just means that it's taking by name, right, just some nomenclature. It's taking blood to the arm, that's the brachium, and it's taking blood to the head, which is cephalic. So brachiocephalic means both head and arm right here. And on the right side of the body, right, then that brachiocephalic bifurcates into a common carotid and a subclavian, and this is named because it does what? It goes just right underneath the clavicle or subclavian. Okay. When the subclavian passes by the axillary region, then we call this the axillary artery. When it goes into the arm, then we call it the brachial artery. Even though it's the same blood vessel, without bifurcating, it's given different names because it's in different parts of the body. Okay. All right, and then you end up down here past the elbow at the radial and ulnar arteries. All right, let's look at this region right here. Let's really zoom into this region. Okay, so then first is the brachiocephalic, second is the common carotid on the left side of the body, then the third is the subclavian coming off the arch of the aorta on the left side of the body. But let's look at this region right here. After the bifurcation of the brachiocephalic, and we don't say right or left, because how many brachiocephalic arteries do you have? There's just one, so you don't have to say right or left, you just have to know it's on the right side of the body. After the bifurcation to the common carotid and subclavian, the first branch is a blood vessel that is taking blood to the brain, and we call this the vertebral artery. Because guess what part of your body it goes through to get to the brain? It goes through the vertebral column, right? So it goes through a number of vertebrae. What kind of vertebrae are in this region right here in the neck? What do we call that? That's cervical. What was one distinguishing feature of cervical vertebrae? It had transverse foramina for this vertebral artery to take blood to the brain, right? And so here is the common carotid. Here's the external carotid. Here's internal carotid. Internal takes blood to the brain along with this vertebral. Those are the only two arteries that bring blood to the brain, internal carotid and vertebral. Of course, you have a right and a left. And this region right here is the region that I was speaking about before. This is the carotid sinus. Okay. What else do we want to see on this diagram? Let's look at some branches off the aorta. So let's zoom into this region right here. So here is descending aorta, but in particular, the abdominal division. This hole in the diaphragm is called the hiatus, right? Abdominal hiatus, which the aorta goes through. And you see some blood vessels leave in pairs. Like I see two blood vessels right here. I see two blood vessels right here coming off the artery, aorta. And then sometimes it comes off as just a single branch. Here I just see a single branch. And that's because in your abdominal cavity, you have sometimes one organ, but sometimes you have pairs of organs, like kidneys. How many kidneys do you have? You have two. So you have two branches coming off the aorta. So this is what we call a paired branch. You have a couple paired branches and a couple unpaired branches. Unpaired branches go to organs that you only have one of. So what kind of organs in your abdominal cavity? We haven't studied it yet. Maybe you're not familiar with that, but you could probably take a wild guess. What kind of organs in your abdominal cavity do you only have one copy of, not two copies? like one liver, one stomach, one spleen, okay, one small intestine. So you don't need pairs of branches to go to those organs, you just need a single unpaired branch. So let's look at these branches. Let's look at unpaired branches first. I see one here, I see one here, and one here. There's only three. Let me zoom in even some more. This right here is what we call the celiac trunk. So it's just a single blood vessel that comes off the aorta, and then it bifurcates into a hepatic artery that goes to the liver. So anytime you hear hepato or hepatic, what organ should you be thinking of? Yeah, liver. Just like when you hear pulmonary, what organ should you be thinking of? Pulmonary has to do with the lungs, right? And when you hear chondro, you should think of cartilage. And when you hear osteo, you should think of bone, for instance, all right? So hepatic artery goes to the liver. There's a gastric artery that goes to the stomach. There's a splenic that goes to the spleen, okay? So that's just an unpaired branch. Here is a superior mesenteric artery. And mesenteries are the membranes that small intestine and large intestines are suspended in, they're surrounded by. So this goes to small intestine. And then here's another unpaired branch, and it's the last one. This is the inferior mesenteric. So these are the unpaired branches that you should know. Celiac trunk, superior mesenteric, and inferior mesenteric. All right, as far as paired branches, right, you got two kidneys. So you got a right and a left renal artery. So whenever you hear that term renal, you should think of kidney, for instance. All right, you have paired branches that go to the adrenal glands. These are glands that are on top of the kidneys. All right, I don't see it on this diagram, but there's a pair of branches there. And then you have the gonadal arteries. You have two gonads. All right, and there are two kinds of gonads. What are the two kinds of gonads in human population? Yeah, ovaries or testes, right? So it's either going to go to an ovary or testes through these arteries right here. So those are all the branches off the abdominal division of the aorta. All right, make sure you can answer these questions right here. Oh, I just looked at the word slide for pulmonary circulation. Make sure you know pulmonary arteries high or low in oxygen, right? And pulmonary veins, you should know automatically if they're high and low in oxygen. All right, so where are we going to start next time? Okay, we're going to start with common carotid artery next time. So the slide, the good slide that if you want to look ahead of time at is going to be this slide right here. Okay, a lot of this slide you already know, but I want to go over it one more time. Okay, so that's it for today's lecture.